Finding the right flight instructor can sometimes be difficult. Teaching styles, scheduling, and differing goals can all affect the student-instructor dynamic and relationship. Hopefully, those things can be discovered before time and money are wasted. Lots to consider. But what if the instructor dozes off during a lesson? It happened to a student, and it's the first of two incidents with that same instructor. We'll call it sleeping on the job. On this episode of I Laughed, I learned about flying from Matt. Hello everyone, I'm Rob Ryder, and welcome to episode 77 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco Insurance. My guest on today's program has had a long journey as a student pilot. He learned that it's not just lift, weight, thrust, and drag that make an airplane fly. Money has to be part of that equation. He's finally on track to earning his private ticket, but the vivid memories from a couple of I Laughed incidents and the lessons learned from his first flight instructor more than 20 years ago are what we'll hear about today, right after this message from Avemco. Since 1961, Avemco has been the only aircraft insurance company that lets you speak directly with a decision maker, empowered to improve coverage based on your unique situation. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 for a quote and save an instant 5% for being an I Laughed listener. Save even more for most recurrent training, a new rating, or participating in Fast Team Wings. Just ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can qualify and how much you'll save. Now, I learned about flying from that. All of us want to find the best flight instructor, and that is part of what our I Laughed story today is about, in getting the right flight instructor and finding sometimes that maybe the flight instructor you have might not have been or might not be the right guy. We're going to find out right now. Chris Johnston, welcome to I Laughed.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Hopefully, what we learn from our flight instructors is good and helps us to be better pilots, but you had a couple of negative experiences, one of which was potentially deadly. These incidents took place a long time ago, but your love of aviation began long before that. Tell me about how flying got into your blood.
Sure, Rob. Well, my love of flying started probably when I was born. My dad was an Army aviator. He flew helicopters in Vietnam, and then he transitioned to fixed wings in Fort Monroe, Virginia. He was part of TRADOC there, and he flew King Airs. And some of my earliest memories, I was born in Germany, but then my earliest memories are being in the hangar there at Fort Monroe and just kind of being in and out of King Airs.
What is TRADOC? I'm not familiar with that acronym.
That's the training indoctrination for the pilots of the King Airs.
Gotcha. Well, the King Airs provided a great deal of service to the Army during Vietnam, as did the Twin Bonanzas and things like that. So your flying is very, very deep within your soul.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. My dad, as long as I can remember, my dad grew up with Flying Magazine coming to the house. And and then when I showed an interest in it, as I got older, he passed them off to me up until frankly, the day he died, I was looking at flying magazines with him.
That's a wonderful story. Well, when did you first start your training? How old were you and where were you and what did you fly?
It was in 2001 when I started. I was 26 years old in Keene, New Hampshire, and I was flying a Piper Warrior 140. And I just called up the local FBO and they said, hey, there's a guy over here that does some teaching. And so I said, great, I'm in. Let's go flying. I didn't interview him. I didn't sit down and talk with him. I just said, let's go flying. I was too excited to be in the air.
Was he a young guy, or tell me about his age?
Sure, he was in his 50s. He had been an agriculture pilot. He'd been a bush pilot up in Maine. He'd flown for many, many, many years. And he was just making some money teaching people how to fly from Maine, New Hampshire, and kind of all over the Northeast of the Northeast.
On a couple of levels, his skill as an agricultural and a bush pilot gave him significant stick and rudder experience that I'm sure translated into good habits for you as a pilot. And being a guy who was in his 50s, he wasn't running off to try to find a job with the airlines. So you, on two levels, you've got the perfect guy.
By all indications, we absolutely had the perfect instructor.
And that is going to lead to what happened that maybe gave you some information that maybe he wasn't the perfect instructor. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the story where things maybe weren't going as properly as you thought?
Yeah, in mid-2001, probably about May, if I'm reading the scribblings in my logbook correctly, I took off out of the Keene Airport in the Warrior, and we took off. It was, as I remember, it was a beautiful afternoon, as some would say, severe clear. It was a gorgeous afternoon, and we climbed up to about 5,000 feet, and he had me turn off to the west to fly out over Vermont. And so, I remember that first flight, Rob, taking off and pulling back on the yoke, and I'm airborne, and he has his hand on the controls, but I'm flying the airplane. And we take off, and we climb out, and we turn off to the west, and I'm climbing up, and he says, climb up to 5,000 feet. I said, great. So I'm watching the altimeter, I'm watching out the window and everything, and I'm coming up to 4,500 feet or so, almost to 5,000. And I said something to him about coming up to 5,000, and there was no response. And so I said again, and I'm, of course, I'm sweating, right? Because I'm flying for the first time, so I'm nervous.
Was this your first flight with the guy?
First flight ever.
Oh, my goodness.
First flight ever being in a general aviation aircraft under my own command. Or not my own command, but, where I was at the controls. And so I asked again about what to do at 5,000 feet, and there was nothing. And I look over, and his head's tilted off to the window, and he's sleeping. So I elbowed him, and he jumps awake, and he said, huh? And I said, hey, I'm flying here. I said, this is the first time I've ever been in a general aviation aircraft. You got to stay awake with me, buddy.
What was his excuse?
He said, I'm sorry, I had a big lunch.
He must have had some turkey or something with a lot of tryptophan in it.
That's what I figure, yeah. So he stayed awake for the rest of the flight, fortunately, and we got some good work done up there, just the fundamentals of flight and whatnot.
Did you continue to fly with that guy even after that particular incident?
I did, Rob. I like to think of myself as being a relatively intelligent human, but that was that should have been a red flag to me. But I was so young and so excited to be in the air that I didn't let that be a red flag. I continued to fly with him for another number of months. We started in May, and we flew up through November of 2001 together.
How many hours had you accumulated by that time, and did he sign you off for solo?
Yes, sir. I was signed off for solo. I was signed off for solo cross country, and I had a total of 24.3 hours in my logbook.
At what point did he solo? How many hours did you have when he soloed you? Do you recall that?
Well, I can look in my logbook, Rob, because I actually kept that thing from 2001 all the way up to today. And my solo was in October of 2001.
So you had somewhere probably 20 hours.
I did. I think it was about 16.
16. That's great.
If my math is right.
That's good.
Yeah.
So he was teaching you some good stuff. If he felt confident to sign you off to solo, he felt that you were ready to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Had you done any night flying with him? Did he fall asleep at night?
We did do some night flying, and there was, he didn't fall asleep at all.
Night flying over New Hampshire and Vermont probably is a lot different than night flying over where I live near Cincinnati when there are a lot of lights. It's probably very close to instrument flying for you at that out there, isn't it?
It is. It's, you know, you take off of the Comwind runway in Keene, New Hampshire at 02, and you climb up to 2,000 feet, and Boston looks like it's right next door to you because it's very dark.
You say you flew up until November. What happened in November? Did you keep flying? Because when we did our little pre-conference on the phone, you told me you were still working on your private pilot's license here in 2024. So what happened in November of 2001? Did you quit or what?
I did, Rob. I ran out of money. As so many, as is so often the story with folks in general aviation, I just ran out of money. My kids were young. I think my youngest was 5 at that point. So I had 5, 7, and would have been 12 at the time.
What changed that you were able to go back, and where did you find an instructor then?
Well, I went back in 2010. I went back and I was flying with a friend of mine that's now a check pilot for American Airlines. But I had him take me up in 2010 because there was in 2002, my previous flight instructor who I had my first ILAF incident with and my second that I'll tell you about in a few minutes, I wanted him to take me up and because I was hoping to get back into flying in general aviation. And make sure that I hadn't learned anything that was going to get me killed, because I found out that my first flight instructor had perished in a general aviation accident. He crashed into a mountain in low IFR conditions, and it was a late night flight. So the potential that there was fatigue or weather or something in the mountains of Maine that caused him to perish in that flight.
I'm assuming that had a very significant effect on what kind of confidence you would have in yourself to start again. Is that why you went up with this other pilot?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I was very concerned that there was something in my thinking or in my pre-flight and my planning, just in the way that I would hold aviation in my brain. I was concerned that there was something that might cause a crash on my part. So that was why I went up, and I got 5 hours with him in 2010. And then I realized I was traveling at the time. I was traveling too much to really give aviation the time that it deserved, even though the funding wouldn't have been so difficult at that point. But I felt like if I was going to be a good pilot, I needed to fly more. So I went up with him, and then I took another 13-year break and started in 2023 again.
Do you have a new instructor now?
I do. Yep. I've got a great new instructor. In fact, I interviewed 3 instructors this time, and I chose someone who is in his early 30s. He is on his way to the airlines, but he and I are going to do my private, my commercial, and my instruments and my multi-engines. We're going to do those in 2024. That's the plan.
Wow, that's good. Well, I'm glad you're back in the saddle. So let's now back up again to 2001 with your first instructor, the guy who you caught napping on your first flight. That's unbelievable. But then you also mentioned Keene, New Hampshire, and the Comwind runway 02. That figures significantly in your next part of the ILAFT incident. Tell me that story.
Like I said, I'm young, right? I'm Lee Young. I'm excited to get flying, and the weather was marginal for us to go up and do any pattern work. So I was excited to get up, and he said, hey, let's do it. So the field elevation at Keene is 500 feet, 488 officially, I believe, on the charts. But so, you know, you need a 1,500-foot ceiling on the clouds in order to really do good pattern work. And if I remember correctly, and this is, you know, this is going back over 20 years, Rob, but if I remember correctly, the AWOS was reporting a 1,600-foot ceiling. So it was extremely marginal for doing any pattern work. And like you said, the Comwind runway in Keene is 02. So my flight instructor says, you know, we always go off of 02. He said, let's take off of 20 today just for something different, so they have a different sight picture.
Winds are calm, so it's not an issue, except that the Comwind runway is actually published as 02.
Absolutely, that's correct. So winds are calm, it's a beautiful day, a beautiful wind day. Like I said, the airport's, the ceiling's really low. And so we turn on the radio after we do all of our pre-flights, and I heard someone on the radio saying something, words that were foreign to me, but they said that they were on the ILS for 02 Keene missed approach. Now, I'm still a low-hour student. I don't know what these words mean. And I failed in that I didn't check in with my flight instructor, but I figured he's hearing the same thing I'm hearing. He's still saying take off at 20. So I heard again while we were doing our work, I heard somebody say missed approach on the ILS for 02 Keene. And I pulled out onto the runway anyway, taxied out onto the runway, poured the coals to it, and took off on 20. So I'm climbing up through 1100, which is 600 feet above the ground. And I had a really bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. It was just this, something wasn't right. And so I turned out to the left and I kicked the rudder. And right at that moment, I saw this plane pop out of the clouds right where I would have been. He was so close. I could see the whites of his eyes, Rob. I was,
oh boy,
absolutely just, I was terrified. Even though the danger had passed at that point, but I kept flying the aircraft, and the person that was on their instruments, they came on the radio, and they were they had some choice words for me, and my flight instructor got on the radio and he said, well, why don't you come back around and put it on the ground, and you know, you and I and the student pilot will call the FAA. And we'll let them sort it out. And the guy had a few more choice words, and then he departed the area.
Did your flight instructor, when he saw the airplane, he had to have seen it when you did. Did he grab for the controls, or did you just, had you already initiated things? Did he not see it as quickly as you did?
He asked me why I had turned out early. And then just when that aircraft popped out of the clouds, I said, that's why. And I continued to turn, and he never touched the controls.
And you landed the airplane, shut down. Did he ever say anything else about that? Did you question him, Chris, about whether or not he had heard that radio call from the other airplane that was on the ILS and the missed approach?
So I didn't question him specifically about whether he had heard that radio call or anything like that. I did ask him to explain to me what happened and why that guy was coming down so low and why he had me go off of 20, and he just reiterated that it was a beautiful day and he didn't see any a beautiful wind day, not a beautiful Sunday, but he just said it just didn't seem like a problem. So it seemed like he wasn't paying attention.
Was that the last time you flew with him?
That I recall, no, it was not the last time, but it should have been.
Chris, we have a great deal to unpack about what you learned about flying from that. Let's take a break, and we'll be back after this message. There's only one aircraft insurance company that invites you to call them and actually discuss your situation with an aviation insurance specialist. That company is Avemco. What kind of flying do you do? What if you don't fly all winter? Why is it just as bad to have too much insurance as too little? Is there a penalty just for being an older pilot? Call 800-338-8705 or visit avemco.com/flying. Either way, tell them you're an I Laughed listener and you'll save an additional 5%. Now, back to I Laughed. We're back with Chris Johnston, a guy who has spent time in radio and law enforcement and works in search and rescue. You have had an incredible career, but your flying has been interrupted and you're still not to the private pilot license status yet, but you're going to get there this year, correct?
Yes, sir. I'm on course. We're going to do it.
And you have learned over the years some incredible lessons, two of them very, very early in your flight training. Tell us about what you learned about flying from that with respect to your instructor and what happened on that near miss up at Keene, New Hampshire.
The first thing that I learned when I went back to look for a flight instructor in 2023, I looked around at a few different airports and I looked around at a number of different flight instructors and I interviewed each one of them. I spent time chatting with them. I spent time, either on the phone or in person. And I felt like that was what I missed the first time. I was so excited to get back in the air. Not that I'm not excited now, but I have another 20 plus years of wisdom under my belt. And I said, if I take some time now to interview these guys, to chat with them, maybe they won't fall asleep on me on my first flight. Maybe they won't give us a near miss. That was my number one thing, because I wanted to understand their background, where they were headed, what their safety margins were, their personal safety margins. And one of the most telling things for me was one of the gentlemen that I wound up selecting as my flight instructor this time around. When we were talking about cross countries, he said, the FAA requires 30 minutes of fuel beyond your destination. And the flight instructor said, I prefer that my students have 45 minutes to an hour. And that, Rob, was exactly what I needed to hear, because that told me that here is a flight instructor that values safety and he won't fall asleep on me. And he will likely not allow me to get into a situation where we're going to have a near miss.
Let me ask you this, Chris. Did your other flight instructor take you at any time into a controlled field so you got a feel for the increased radio traffic and the speed at which instructions are given? Did you have that kind of opportunity, or did you spend all your time at a non-towered field?
I got to ask one time. I said, can we go to a towered field? And he said, sure, we can go to Lebanon, New Hampshire. And Lebanon, New Hampshire is a towered field, but in the middle of the week, it's not very busy. So I had one communication with the tower, and that was, that's not true. I called when I was 10 miles out, so it was a couple communications, and they said, we'll call the water tower, because I was approaching from the south. So I called the water tower, and they said, you're cleared straight in. And that was it.
Gosh.
So I didn't get the feel for what a real towered airport is like.
Working in the system was not part of your instruction at that point.
It wasn't. And frankly, I think with my first flight instructor's life surrounding agriculture and bush flying, I'm not sure that he was really interested or even comfortable flying into controlled fields.
What did you learn about flying from that with respect to taking off on the runway, which was not the published Comwind runway?
That's a great question, Rob. And there was a number of things that I learned from that particular incident. The first one was, if the published runway for Comwind is what you use, if it's a if it's a calm day, it doesn't matter that it's a calm day and you can go anywhere. What matters is we have rules for a reason. And if we had been doing what we were supposed to do, what the rules told us we were supposed to do, there wouldn't have been an issue. There never would have been a potential for a mid-air collision. So number one, I learned, follow the rules. They're there for your safety. They're there for a reason. The second thing that I learned from that particular day was to question if something doesn't sit right with me or if I don't understand something, ask the question of the flight instructor. You can always pause. I mean, if you're not in the middle of a takeoff roll or if you're not landing the plane, if you're still on the ground, you can always pause and ask the question, hey, what does a missed approach on 02 mean? Does that mean that they're coming near us? Does that mean that they're staying at 5,000 feet? What does that mean? So I think asking the question of a flight instructor, don't just assume that they're listening to the radio, that they're comprehending what's on the radio, not comprehending, but that they're processing it, because they might be thinking about what they're going to have you as the student do that day. They might be thinking about making sure that they logged your time correctly or that they logged Hobbs meter correctly. Who knows what they're thinking about? So if there's anything that doesn't sit right, absolutely ask the question of your flight instructor and make sure that as a student, we understand what's happening around us.
Chris, you're a new flight instructor. You say as a guy who is going to the airlines, but is he going to be able to stay with you through your getting your private ticket and moving on to those other ratings that you've discussed?
Well, I certainly hope so, Rad. He'll definitely be with me through my private and my commercial. I know he's getting up there in hours, but I also, after having flown with now three flight instructors, they each bring something special to the table. So I'm not really concerned about going to find someone else, because now, being a bit older and having some more wisdom under my belt, I feel like I will question any new flight instructor that I get and interview them just as rigidly as I did with my flight instructor now.
Has your new flight instructor signed you off to solo yet?
Not yet. We're getting awfully close, but he's very good at making sure that everything that we do is precision. So he hasn't signed me off yet. He wants to make sure that I'm dead on accurate before I go out and do any solos or anything.
And by the way, what are you flying now? It was Warriors before, or Cherokee 140 before, what now?
I'm back in a Warrior.
Excellent. Well, Chris, I wish you all the best as you proceed on to your achieving your private pilot's license, earning that and going on to your other ratings. I am very, very grateful that you shared the stories. I am so glad you're alive to tell them, especially given the fact that approach that day at Keene was so close to being a collision. Chris Johnston, thank you so much for being on I Laughed.
Rob, thanks for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm looking forward to hearing from Chris as he works through his flight training and adds those advanced ratings. It was very, very nice to connect with him. And if you've got an I Laughed incident that you think could help others learn a valuable lesson, send me an email with a synopsis of your story. We'll consider it for an episode. My email address is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. As we move into our fourth year of I Laughed, I want to thank all of you for listening, and I hope that you'll subscribe and share it with your friends. I Laughed is available wherever you get your podcasts, and we drop episodes every couple of weeks so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. The I Laughed theme and commercial instrumental music for the podcast was written and performed by Rob Pottorff. Kate O'Connor is managing editor of Flying Magazine, and Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.